Rolling Stone, Rolling Stone. Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother? Yeah. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? This is Dan Klingel, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we're continuing to read from a special collector's edition of Rolling Stone magazine on Prince, the ultimate guide to his music legend. When our last session concluded, we were about halfway through an article entitled Prince Talks, as he readied his movie Graffiti Bridge. The Restless Genius offered a glimpse into his creative world, and this is by Neil Carlin. Prince says he'll survive if Graffiti Bridge is less than a blockbuster. I can't please everybody, he says. I didn't want to make Die Hard 4. But I'm also not looking to be Francis Ford Coppola. I see this more like those 1950s rock and roll movies. Prince cues up the Graffiti Bridge movie sequence in which the time performs Shake. The scene looks like something Busby Berkeley would have cooked up if he had had choreographed funk. Originally, Graffiti Bridge was going to be a vehicle for the reborn time, with Prince staying behind the camera. But Warner Brothers wouldn't go for it, so Prince wrote himself into a new movie. Later, visitors to Paisley Park saw a version of a script that was allegedly obtuse to the point of near gibberish. That was just a real, rough, 30-page treatment I wrote with Kim, Prince says. Graffiti Bridge is an entirely different movie. This year, Prince reunited with The Time, a Minneapolis funk band fronted by Morris Day, who he'd fallen out with after Purple Rain. They broke up because they'd run out of ideas, he says. They went off and did their own thing, and now they're terrifying. Recently, Prince broke up The Revolution, surprising many fans. I felt we all needed to grow, he says. We all needed to play a wide range of music with different types of people. Then we could all come back 8 times as strong. No band can do everything, he continues. For instance, this band I'm with now is funky. With them, I can drag out Baby I'm a Star all night. I just keep switching gears on them, and something else funky will happen. I couldn't do that with The Revolution. They were a different kind of funky, more electronic and cold. The Revolution could tear up Darling Nikki, which was the coldest song ever written. But I wouldn't even think about playing that song with this band. The breakup of The Revolution apparently didn't go down easy. Today, Prince's relationship with his one-time best friends Wendy Melvoin and Lisa Coleman is somewhere between uncomfortable and estranged. I talk to Wendy and Lisa, but it's like this, Prince says, moving his hands in opposite directions. I still hear a lot of hurt from them, and that bothers me. When I knew them, they were two spunky, wonderful human beings. I honestly don't know what they're hurt about. So far, Prince says, the two women haven't listened to the few tidbits of advice he has offered. For their first video, Prince recommended that they try to announce themselves by making a splash, by, quote, doing something like jumping off a speaker with smoke pouring out everywhere, something, unquote. When he saw the video, however, Wendy was sitting in a chair playing her guitar. You can't do that when you're just getting established. Kids watching MTV see that and they go, click, Prince says, mimicking a channel being changed. They'd rather watch a commercial. Still, Prince's pronouncements seem proffered more in mourning than in malice. Wendy and Lisa are going to have to do some more serious soul-searching. They need to decide what they want to write about, he says sadly and shakes his head. I don't know what Wendy and Lisa are so hurt about. I wish I did, but I don't. It's a broiling summer afternoon in Nice, France, and Prince is performing before an almost completely empty soccer stadium. It's a sound check, and Prince and his band have been going for more than an hour, segueing from John Lee Hooker's I'm in the Mood to the freeform jamming in Respect. After the check, Prince retreats to the bowels of the stadium to wait for night.
Camped out in his dressing room under a gaucho hat, Prince plugs in a tape bearing some early versions of songs he's written on tour. Prince says the first song, called Schoolyard, is about the first time I got any. I think that's something everybody can relate to. Still, that probably wouldn't prevent the song from getting a parental warning sticker. I don't mind that, Prince says. I think parents have a right to know what their children are listening to. At first, it seems an unlikely sentiment coming from the man who once wrote about the onanistic doings of a woman sitting with a magazine in a hotel lobby. But Prince has changed his outlook on how to present his erotic creations. The change, he says, came soon after he finished the Black Album in 1987. The reason the album was pulled from release had nothing to do with record company pressure, he insists, or with the quality of the songs. Rather, Prince says, he aborted the project because of one particular dark night of the soul when a lot of things happened all in a few hours. He won't get specific, saying only that he saw the word God. And when I talk about God, he says, I don't mean some dude in a cape and a beard coming down to earth. To me, he's in everything if you look at it that way. I was very angry a lot of the time back then, he continues, and that was reflected in that album. I suddenly realized that we can die at any moment, and we'd be judged by the last thing we left behind. I didn't want that angry, bitter thing to be the last thing. By the time of his 1988 album, Love Sexy, Prince says, he was a nicer human being and a happier creator. I feel good most of the time, and I like to express that by writing from joy, he says. I still do write from anger sometimes, like in Thieves in the Temple, but I don't like to. It's not a place to live. He's been angling for a different effect on each album he has made in the past few years. While being so productive on his own, Prince has also found time to produce such disparate talents as Mavis Staples, George Clinton, and Bonnie Raitt. The best thing about producing is that there are so many really talented people out there who just never got that push over the top, he says. Without that push, they just get lost. What Prince listens to on his own time is a grab bag. He likes rap. He's recently signed rappers T.C. Ellis and Robin Power to record on his Paisley Park label, but denies that he'll be producing songs for MC Hammer. I like his stuff a lot, Prince says. We've talked, but not about working together. He also gives highly favorable mentions to the likes of Madonna, Michael Jackson, Patti LaBelle, and Bette Midler. I'm not real into Bruce Springsteen's music, he says, but I have a lot of respect for his talent. Prince and Springsteen occasionally exchange notes. In recalling a Springsteen concert he saw from backstage a few years back, Prince displays the respect of a general reviewing another man's army. I admire the way he holds his audience. There's one man whose fans I could never take away, he says with a laugh. And how does he compare their stage tactics? I'm not sure, says Prince. But at one point, his band started going off somewhere. Springsteen turned around and shot the band one terrifying look. You know they got right back on it. For his own enjoyment, however, Prince usually relies on himself. I like a lot of people's music, and I'm interested in what's going on, he says. But I don't listen to them. When I'm getting ready to go out or driving in the car, I listen to my own stuff. Never the old stuff. That's the way it's always been. Prince walks back over to the stereo and plays with the cassette of his latest creations until he finds a number featuring Rosie Gaines, his band's unknown keyboardist and vocalist who may be the next big star, to come out of Prince's camp. Terrifying, says Prince, shaking his head. Simply terrifying. For now, Prince has no plans to bring his tour to the States. He'd rather get back into the studio. He wants to get rolling on a screenplay he's been working on with Gilbert Davison, his best friend, his chief adjutant. He is also the owner and proprietor of the soon-to-open Minneapolis nightclub, Glam Slam. Prince has lent the club his full endorsement, as well as his name, the motorcycle from Purple Rain, and some of his more historic guitars. Glam Slam's going to kick ass, Prince says. It'll be one of those joints that's remembered. I've just always wanted to have a place where I knew I could just show up and my stuff would be there, so I wouldn't have to jump on stage with equipment meant for Dwight Yoakam. He continues, Glam Slam will be another thing to center Minneapolis in the national eye, he says. People talk about the Minneapolis sound or the Minneapolis scene, but they don't really know what the place looks like or means. I want it to mean something. For Prince, the place still mostly just means home. It feels like music to me there, he says. You don't feel prejudice there. I know it exists, but you don't feel it as much. I can just drive around the lakes or go into stores without bodyguards or just hang out. Nursing a cold and chewing on Sudafed, Prince excuses himself to rest up for the show. The next time he appears in the doorway, his intimidating game face is on. The band comes in for a last-minute huddle. Paisley Park costume designer Helen Hyatt fixes a crucifix necklace big enough to scare off Nosferatu. It's raining, Davison says to Prince. It's raining, is Prince's mumbled reply, accompanied by a thousand-yard stare. Moments later, an army of damp and screaming Swiss teenagers hear the first beat of 1999. Hours after the show is over, Prince, his band, and an entire entourage of about 30 are flying into their third country in the past 24 hours. They're all sacked out in what looks like the sleep of the dead. Everybody's unconscious on this charter, including one of the flight attendants. There's movement, however, up in row one. Prince's headphoned head is bopping against the back of his seat, his arms pounding the armrests. From the back, it looks like a prisoner is being executed in an upholstered electric chair. Earlier in the day, Prince had refused to make any predictions about the future. I don't want to say anything that can be held against me later, he'd said with a laugh. Mick Jagger said he hoped he wouldn't be singing Satisfaction at 30, and he's still singing. Pete Townsend wrote, Hope I die before I get old. Well, now he is old, and I do hope he's happy to be around. And himself? When I pray to God, I say, It's your call. When it's time to go, it's time to go. But as long as you're going to leave me here, he slapped his hands, then I'm going to cause much ruckus. Now, while his bandmates and support staff snooze around him, Prince keeps air jamming beneath the glare of his seat's tiny spotlight. Listening to a tape of his own performance that day, Prince stays up all night, all the way to London. The next article in this Rolling Stone special edition is Burning Down the House. 20 years after Purple Rain, Prince reclaimed his crown with a funk-filled new album and an exhilarating tour. This by Anthony DeCurtis, and it was excerpted from a Rolling Stone magazine of May 27, 2004. Hammering, that's the word, that's it. Prince folds over in laughter and stamps his high-heel boots on the floor. Those heels, as it turns out, are clear plastic, and lights twinkle within them. It's a perfect metaphor for the electricity that seems to be coursing through the singer at the moment. Prince is responding to a description of the torrid version of DMSR, a jam from 1999 touting the virtues of dance, music, sex, romance, that he and his backing band, the New Power Generation, unleashed earlier that evening in the sold-out Gund Arena in Cleveland. It was a full-on funk stomp that got the house up and shaking. Hammering only begins to convey the performance's pulverizing rhythmic assault. Pulverizing, that's good too, Prince says, laughing again. What you see is people responding to what this band is and what we're doing. It's just 20 minutes after the show, and at a time when most performers would be just beginning to cool down, Prince is utterly composed. He's crisply dressed in a purple tunic and black pants, He looks as if he has spent the evening relaxing in his living room rather than burning down a 20,000-seat house. But that's how effortless things seem to be of late for the 45-year-old musician. Everybody in the Prince camp, most definitely beginning with Prince himself, bristles when anyone suggests that the current wave of Prince mania constitutes a comeback. The official line is that he never went away. From a strictly literal standpoint, of course, that's true. He's been as busy as ever, using his own label and his website, the New Power Generation Music Club, to release CDs such as The Rainbow Children in 2001 and NEWS in 2003, as well as the DVD Prince Live at the Aladdin, Las Vegas. But whether or not you buy the message that Prince never left, it's clear many of his millions of fans had gone somewhere in recent years, and now many are staging a comeback of their own. Suddenly, liking Prince doesn't feel like such a chore. In fact, it's fun. His stripped-down, pleasingly straightforward new album, Musicology, delivers on the promise of his spellbinding performances earlier this year on the Grammy Awards and at his induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Nearly a recluse before, Prince is now all over the media, chatting on talk shows, posing for photographers, being interviewed by reporters. It's like an old friend has returned. His live shows have become ecstatic parties, sweaty two-hour romps. "This is school for me," says saxophonist Michael Phillips, 27, of playing with Prince. "Every night I watch how he connects his gift to the crowd. I've spoken to him about it. He told me that playing a solo is like making love. You have to pay attention to the things that make your partner respond and space them out so they come at exactly the right time. It's one big, long orgasm." If not exactly a new element in Prince's music, the interplay among the musicians is something Prince is now actively encouraging. He is someone who often plays every instrumental part on his records, and while he has always attracted superb musicians, he's been criticized for rarely giving them the freedom to fully express their talent. As far as he was concerned, he knew how the part should go. Their job was to play it. "Those days are gone. The shows are a lot looser," he says, leaning back on the couch. "I used to be more involved with every aspect of everything on stage. I'm way more relaxed now. It just feels like anything can happen. That's one of the reasons we're doing these shows in the round. The music is at the center of everything," he continues. "This show is much more about the songs than the staging, which is very simple. We've also been playing in clubs on some nights, and we carry that with us into the arenas. As raucous as the show sometimes appears, everything is, in fact, occurring within a larger, orderly plan. Prince, of all people, believes that improvisation isn't a virtue in itself. Even spontaneous gestures must be meaningful. Only rigorous rehearsals make that possible, and this band is flawless and taut." During a sound check in New York one evening, Prince was working with the crew on lighting cues. He'd casually count off song parts. "Okay, second verse, from the top." And the nine-piece band would instantly fall in exactly in time. It was as impressive as anything in the show itself. "Oh, you can't go out there unless you've got the show completely in shape," Prince says after the Cleveland gig. "It can look pretty wild on stage, but everyone knows exactly where they're supposed to be. That was a lesson I had to learn from when I was starting out. When we first went out behind 1999, The Time, who were opening for us, beat us up every night. They'd laugh about it. It was a joke to them. Our show wasn't together. I had to stop the tour and get things tightened up. Now me and the band have a certain relationship with each other, and every night we make the audience part of that." It's hard to tell precisely what accounts for the more easygoing Prince. He refuses to speak about any aspect of his private life, but his becoming a Jehovah's Witness a few years back has seemingly brought him a good deal of spiritual calm. The religion's combination of absolute certainty and convoluted interpretive zeal suits him perfectly. He began his remarks at the Hall of Fame induction by offering all praise and thanks to the Most High Jehovah, and his additional declaration there that too much freedom can lead to the soul's decay should be read as his acceptance of the strict tenets of that faith. He has expunged all profanity from his language and refuses to perform any of his racier songs, No Darling Nikki, No Head, No Get Off. Prince has even become an unlikely advocate for cleaning up the airwaves. This culture is in big trouble, he insists. All you see on television are debased images. Whether you believe it or not, black people do not want to see pictures of people wearing bulletproof vests. Prince's marriage to 27-year-old Manuela Testolini in 2001 seems also to have settled him. Beautiful, slender, and soft-spoken, she was by his side virtually every moment he wasn't on stage in Cleveland. The past 7 years or so have not been easy for Prince. The child he had with his first wife, Mady Garcia, died from a rare illness after living for only a week. The couple's marriage ended not long after that. Both his parents passed away. Amid all that loss, remarriage and faith appear to have come as great, restorative gifts. As for Prince's public reemergence, L. Londell McMillan, his longtime friend and business partner, says simply, "It began with a yes." McMillan is referring to Prince's surprising agreement to perform on the Grammy Awards after years of turning down such requests. That appearance and his Hall of Fame induction had significant results. Sharing the stage with Beyoncé at the Grammys and being hailed by Outkast and Alicia Keys at the Hall of Fame induction demonstrated to Prince how decisive an influence he has been on an entire generation of younger artists. He was so moved by Keys' speech, quote, "Because of him, I've never wanted to be like anyone but myself. Because of his music, my music has wings to be different," unquote, that a video of it introduces him every night on the Musicology tour. Prince is well aware that his antics in the past have caused him to be portrayed as, in his words, a petulant brat or a megalomaniac. That aspiring musicians heard a call to freedom amid the din of controversy surrounding him couldn't possibly be more important to him. "The respect of young artists, I love that," he says. "Despite everything, no one can dictate who you are to other people. Alicia Keys gets it. All these hip-hop artists, the first thing they do is start their own label and lock their business down. We had a lot to do with that." But perhaps even more important, the initial steps that Prince took to re-engage his fans reignited their passion for his music. "I think people sometimes forget how great a genius he is," McMillan says. Because Musicology is so listener-friendly, Prince overcame his near pathological wariness about record companies and agreed to allow McMillan to work out a deal with Columbia Records. Columbia, which is part of Sony Music, will distribute and help market the album domestically and be reimbursed for the costs of doing so, and license it for sale in the rest of the world. It's an arrangement that essentially requires no upfront costs on the label's part, while providing a strong profit incentive for the company to sell as many copies as possible. On his end, Prince gets the enormous reach of an international corporate powerhouse. According to Sony's president, Don Einar, the label has filled orders for upward of 1 million copies of the album worldwide. Prince received no advance payment from the label, but he retains complete ownership of the album, the whole point of his grueling battle in the 90s with Warner Brothers. One advantage of writing "slave" on my face back then is that when I meet with a label now, they already know they're not going to be owning anything, Prince says wryly. Maybe at one time they could get Little Richard for a new car and a bucket of chicken. We don't roll like that no more. The overall strategy is for Prince to have what McMillan calls an ongoing multi-delivery model for bringing his music to the public. Everything Prince releases will be directly available online to the members of his NPG Music Club. Albums such as Musicology, with a potentially broader appeal, might also receive a major label distribution. More specialized projects, such as the instrumental album Prince has discussed with the Blue Note label, might benefit from another approach. Such imaginative flexibility may not only be ideal for Prince, but might prove essential for record companies in the years ahead, particularly in the wake of the recent upheavals in the music industry. "I want to make hard decisions in business," Prince says. "If you can't do that, you're not free." For a tumultuous run of songs at the end of the Cleveland show, You Got the Look, Life of the Party, Soul Man, and Kiss, Prince invites perhaps 24 women in the audience onto the stage to dance. One willowy girl wears a purple two-piece bathing suit, festooned with the glyph that had become the singer's name for a time. Prince struts over to her, and she becomes his dance partner during Kiss. After the line, "Act your age, not your shoe size," he holds the mic out to her, and right in tune, she sings, "And maybe we can do the twirl." Prince's eyes widen, and he yowls, "Woo!" The security guard wasn't going to let her get on stage, Prince says backstage after the show. "I said, you can't send that girl home dressed like that." Everybody's ready to hit the spy bar in Cleveland's warehouse district for an after party. But Prince and the band won't be doing a late night set there tonight. "I always love to play," he says, "but we've been doing so many shows that I feel like I need to give the band a chance to rest." Asked why he booked a tour with so few days off, Prince smiles and holds his hands out in front of him, as if weighing an object in each. "Let's see," he says, "sleep or $500,000? Sleep or $500,000? But while the cash is obviously welcome, Prince is satisfied by more than money these days. "My fans bring their sons and daughters to my shows now," he says. "That's how I grew up. I hope to be an inspiration to those people. I feel at peace. I knew it would take time, and I had to deal with a lot of ridicule. But this feels like peace right now. Spiritually, I feel very different from the way I used to. But physically, not at all. I don't look at time that way, and I don't believe in age. When you wake up, each day looks the same. So each day should be a new beginning. I don't have an expiration date." The next article is entitled "Our Royal Libertine." Prince was one of rock's greatest sexual revolutionaries, and he inspired his audience to be free and fabulous along with him. This by Will Hermes. Before we begin reading the article, I should mention that there are a few instances of fairly strong profanity in this article. More than any rock star in history, Prince gave his audience permission to get its freak on in the broadest, most democratic sense, to revel in birthright sexiness, to author and blur gender identity, to savor beauty and weirdness, and to fuck like bunnies. And he did it in a way that was more spiritual than decadent. "The second coming, new age revelation," he squealed on controversy. "Sexuality is all we ever need." Along with his idealistic take on race, it was a message of complete liberation, and given our national fetish for freedom, a tremendously American notion. Strictly speaking, Prince was rarely the romantic aggressor in his music. He was vulnerable, wielding maybe the most potent falsetto in pop history. The way he pleads, "Just hold me," post-orgasmic and shivering in "Do Me, Baby," remains one of the most astoundingly naked pop performances by any singer of any gender. Prince posited a revolutionary way to be a straight dude, more co-conspiring than predatory. See, among other songs, "If I Was Your Girlfriend," a slow jam flush with a desire to connect, so profound it obliterates biology, epitomizing the gender morph icon he'd later take as his name. Prince was influenced by his glam rock style. Did any man ever make lace and stockings seem so utterly badass? As well as the slyly feminized masculinity of Little Richard. In doing so, he made answers to lyrics like, "Am I black or white? Am I straight or gay?" irrelevant. If you had a queer bone in your body, the dude jiggled it. Musing on his Tumblr, Frank Ocean cited Prince's 1980 debut appearance on the live concert TV show, The Midnight Special, as a key moment in his own evolution. He learned early on how little value to assign to someone else's opinion of you. He was a straight black man who played his first televised set in bikini bottoms and knee-high heel boots. Epic. He made me feel more comfortable with how I identify sexually simply by his display of freedom from and irreverence for obviously archaic ideas like gender conformity. Bandmate Lisa Coleman fondly considered him a fancy lesbian. The revolution was staged remarkably from the modest platform of a bland Midwestern suburb. In the shadow of the AIDS crisis and Reagan conservatism, mainstreaming the libertine sexualities stirred up in the 70s by punk, new wave, and disco. When I arrived in Prince's mythic Minneapolis in the early 90s, a less risque place in reality than he made it seem, his music always reminded me that boring is only as boring does. Prudes panicked, of course. The masturbatory celebration of Darling Nikki allegedly triggered Tipper Gore to marshal a pop music censorship campaign via the PMRC. Over time, Prince's attitude towards sexuality shifted. Age will do that. Certain actions and statements complicated the image of him as an unblemished paragon of liberation. But generations were led by the example of his greatest work and ran with it. In 1985, Prince began a TV interview on MTV with this pledge, "I live in a small town, and I always will because I can walk around and be me, and that's all I want to be." Indeed, as millions could see, he was just a Minnesota kid being himself, in eyeshadow and pencil mustache, demonstrating that they had no excuse anymore to be less than fabulous, audacious, and sexy as motherfuckers. Our next article is entitled Baby He's a Star, Prince on Film, His Greatest Music Video, Acting Roles, and Live Clips, by Rob Sheffield. The first is I Want to Be Your Lover from American Bandstand, 1979. "They say I'm so shy," Prince sings as he introduces himself to the world in his first high-profile TV appearance, a hot thing who's barely 21. He proves how shy he is in his bashful interview with Dick Clark, where he can barely bring himself to speak more than a syllable, after preening through the song with a feathered mullet and skin-tight gold pants. Clark later called it the single most difficult interview I ever did in my life. The next is Sexuality, a music video from 1981. A raw clip that looks incredibly low-budget and stripped down, as if Prince figured any kind of TV exposure was unthinkable, so he may as well flaunt all his salacious energy for heavy rotation at dance clubs. He moves in a cloud of sex steam, and like a sexually charged response to The Clash, he calls for a new breed of leaders to emerge and free the national libido. Stand up, organize. The next is Party Up from Saturday Night Live in 1981. Back when SNL was rebooting itself with a new cast, the doomed season after Lorne Michaels left, Prince gave the show a badly needed boost with his raw version of Party Up, slipping past the censors with the line, "Fighting war is such a fucking bore." The other musical guest that night, Todd Rundgren. The next is Automatic, a music video from 1982. Unlike 1999 or Little Red Corvette, Automatic didn't get much MTV airplay, maybe on account of the extended S&M interlude where the lady backup singers escort Prince to a brass bed, strip him to the waist, blindfold him, tie him to the frame, and flog him with a sex whip. Now we're on to the music video for 1999, which was released in 1982. At last, his royal badness dons purple robes and claims his throne. This was the video where Prince conquered MTV, which went down without a fight. He dances into the apocalypse, sliding down the Prince pole and strutting through clouds of smoke, with lingerie-clad singers Lisa Coleman and Jill Jones adding commentary as his Greek chorus. The way he air-slaps the camera before unleashing the lion in his pocket is the essence of Prince cool. Next video is Live with James Brown and Michael Jackson in 1983. The legendary live dance-off. James Brown is doing a show in L.A. when he invites Michael Jackson up to stun the crowd with some moonwalking. Then Jackson whispers in Brown's ear, and Brown tells the fans, "He just insisted that I introduce Prince." The Godfather looks around for the purple one in the audience and summons him on stage. You can see how competitive both of these young guys are to impress their idol, not to mention each other. It's the only known performance footage where Prince looks nervous. These three titans on the same stage? It's a wonder the building didn't combust from sheer soul power. Now we're on to the 1984 music video, When Doves Cry. Dig, if you will, this picture. Prince takes off into the stratosphere with a truly shocking sound. Wailing guitar, stuttering drum machines, no bass, and a look to match. He makes a hell of an entrance as he emerges naked from his bathtub and reaches his hand out to the camera. In the mirror image finale, Prince holds the screen just spinning and writhing in front of the revolution in a red bolero hat with a black lace veil. Then Purple Rain, which was a feature film in 1984. His first movie was the semi-autobiographical tale of a sensitive young music prodigy who learns how to heal from his family damage and reach out to other human beings. With some help from Wendy, Lisa, Apollonia, and the world's first ejaculating guitar. It's a tour de force, not for the script, but for his sheer charisma and the weird cast of characters around him, especially the Times' Morris Day, who almost steals the show as the bad guy. If you were lucky enough to see this flick in the theater, you got to join the whole crowd in erupting when Prince announced, "If you know what I'm singing about here, come on, raise your hand." Best scene? Apollonia hops on the back of his bike for a ride to Lake Minnetonka. Spoiler, that ain't Minnetonka. And then from the Oscars, 1985. And the Oscar for Best Original Song Score goes to Prince for Purple Rain, presented by Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner. It's one of the coolest Academy Award acceptance speeches ever. He flounces to the stage in a glittering purple cowl and hood, flanked by Wendy and Lisa, mumbles about God so quietly most of the crowd probably couldn't hear a word, then curtsies and twirls away. Even Joan Rivers must have wondered what the hell was going on here. Next is Raspberry Beret, a music video from 1985. In this quintessential summer hit, Prince invites you to frolic in the psychedelic paisley playground of his dreams, a place up in the sky where all the hippie children can boogie, surrounded by fluffy white clouds. He performs in a sky blue suit decorated with his own personal clouds, with his wet dreams enhanced by pencil animation sex scenes. Next is Under the Cherry Moon, which was a feature film in 1986. Ominous Words, a film by Prince. His eagerly awaited second movie, and first as a director, was the kind of crazed, big-budget folly only a star as magnetic as Prince could have talked a Hollywood studio into releasing. It's a black-and-white art film where he plays Christopher Tracy, a gigolo in France, plying his world-class seduction moves on Kristen Scott Thomas, she making her film debut as a barely dressed heiress. It's unfairly remembered as a disaster, but it's full of Rococo pleasures, if you happen to love his louche side, especially when Prince purrs to his lady. Maybe if you loosen your chastity belt, you could breathe a little mo better. Kiss, music video, 1986. Like the song, the video is all the way minimal. Just Prince sporting a crop top and a rockabilly pompadour, shaking what Mama gave him, with a veiled dancer and his good-humored guitar hero, Wendy, who can barely keep a straight face while she watches him dance. Best move? Prince sliding across the floor on his knees, face first into the dancer's crotch. Sign of the Times was a concert film from 1987. One of the all-time great concert movies, up there with Stop Making Sense and The Last Waltz, except it's surprisingly little known today. It went nowhere at the box office, never came out on DVD, and remains nearly impossible to find on video. Yet fans still hoard their battered VHS tapes, because Prince is shown in peak funk mode, leading his hottest band ever, as Sheila E. goes nuts on the drums. I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man blows the already great studio version away, with Prince blazing on guitar. Whoever you have to sleep with to see this, it's worth it. Next is You Got the Look, which was a music video in 1987. Prince sits backstage in his dressing room, meditating by candlelight, while a roadie irons his outfit. Sheena Easton primps at her bedroom mirror, erotically aroused by the sight of Prince's CD long box. Then Prince dons your grandma's shaggiest white fur coat for one of the most ridiculous sex duets in MTV history, with Easton, a nice Scottish lass known for polite little pop ballads, until Prince got hold of her and turned to Into Miss Sugar Walls. Let's get to ramming, indeed. Next is Get Off, which was at the VMAs in 1991. In case anyone thought he'd gone soft with pop trifles like Bat Dance or Diamonds and Pearls, Prince turned up at the 1991 MTV Video Music Awards ready to raise a few eyebrows. First, he got mounted and pinned to the floor from behind by one of his muscle-bound backup dudes. Then he did his latest hit for 7 minutes in a pair of assless pants. "Let me show you, baby, I'm a talented boy," he sang. Well, he definitely showed something. Next is The Most Beautiful Girl in the World from Soul Train, 1994. A new look for the man, from the phase when he renamed himself after an unpronounceable squiggle. Here he goes on Soul Train in a little Lord Fauntleroy suit, complete with a giant starched white collar, dancing a decidedly unchildlike pas de deux with his future wife, belly dancer matey, who wears a pair of rhinestone-studded handcuffs on her wrist, tantalizingly dangling the empty cuff in front of Prince. Next, Starfish and Coffee from The Muppets Tonight, 1997. A duet that needed to happen. Prince meets the Muppets. He does his most beloved kiddie psychedelia song with a schoolroom full of Muppet children, including a furry little monster as his friend Cynthia Rose, wearing different colored socks and hiding secret treasures in her lunchbox. Then there's Motherless Child, which was from 2TVE in Spain in the year 2000. This from the wilderness years. Though it may have seemed Prince had lost his hit-making clout and most of his audience, he'd not lost his genius, as this performance proves. Prince appears on Spanish TV wearing a hippie cap and a purple guitar. He turns this ancient blues lament into the heaviest rock groove, building up the tension for 9 minutes, letting his guitar do the screaming. This had zero relation to any music that was popular in 2000. Prince was truly in a world all his own. Then from the Grammys in 2004, we have Let's Go Crazy with Beyoncé. 20 years after Purple Rain, Prince opened the 2004 Grammys with this splashy Beyoncé duet. The Queen is resplendent in a barely there pink dress, banging a tambourine while he plays the riffs from Let's Go Crazy in a medley that also cruises through Purple Rain, Baby I'm a Star, and Crazy in Love. Then he tells the crowd, "Don't hate us, 'cause we fabulous." He later praised Bay's musical knowledge. "I was really pleased to find out that she knew a lot about scales. Mix a Lydian scales and Egyptian styles." Then there's While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which was from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004. For the first 3 minutes, it's a reverent tribute to the late George Harrison, with Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne doing their best to copy the original. Then Prince steps forward in a red hat to blow the song wide open, with a demented guitar solo, nearly tumbling off the stage, getting pushed back to his feet, abruptly throwing his guitar up in the air. Did it ever come down? Probably not. And then dueling the world's coolest pimp strut off the stage. This is what it sounds like when guitars weep. Then American Idol 2006. Prince made a top-secret surprise appearance on the season finale, at a time when Idol was a national obsession. He did everything on his own stubborn terms. He refused to sing with any of the contestants and wouldn't even let Ryan Seacrest introduce him. He just appeared unannounced to perform two non-hits from his new album, 3121, Lolita, and Satisfied, with a couple of girl singers, blowing everyone away. Then he left the building. He had a driver waiting right outside so he could make an instant getaway. From the 2007 Super Bowl. Nobody else could have looked this cool taking the stage on a football field in the middle of a Miami thunderstorm. Prince was the MVP at Super Bowl 41. It rained most of the game. Yet he dared it to pour down on him a little harder, utterly unfazed as he torched up his hits and retooled a few surprise rock classics, like All Along the Watchtower and Proud Mary, plus a freaking Foo Fighters cover, Best of You. On an occasion that usually looks choreographed to the last second, Prince seemed to make it all up as he went along, and when the skies opened for his guitar heroics in Purple Rain, he made it look like the storm was just part of his master plan. Nobody has ever seemed less intimidated to find himself center stage at the Super Bowl. In 2015 at the Grammys. In the jaded music world of 2015, at the end of one of the most boring Grammy ceremonies ever, Prince suddenly walks into the room and turns all the celebrities into raving, star-struck fans, cheering like he just reminded them why they all fell in love with music in the first place. He twirls his cane and scoffs at the standing ovation, with the most priceless side-eye ever captured on live TV, then presents the Grammy for Album of the Year. "Albums still matter," he tells the crowd. "Like books and black lives, albums still matter." But after Prince, nobody cared who won a single Grammy. The night belonged to this man, who spun right around and vanished like he owed the music world not a damn thing. And then 2016, live in Atlanta. April 14th, the last concerts of his life, just a week before the final curtain, alone on stage at Atlanta's Fox Theater, on his piano and a microphone tour. He sang David Bowie's Heroes, and for the finale, an achingly vulnerable Purple Rain. From the fan footage, you can see and hear that whatever was ailing the man's body, his spirit was still in an exalted realm all his own, a place the rest of us can only visit through his music. And thanks to the music Prince left behind, it's a place the world will never stop revisiting. We don't have time to finish the next article, so I'm going on to some of the accolades that were paid to Prince by his fellow artists. This section of the magazine is called Nothing Compares. The first accolades are from Questlove. "From the age of 11, Prince was in my ears and in my head. I patterned everything in my life after him. His fashion, his affect, his taste in women, and of course, his taste in music. I wouldn't have listened to Joni Mitchell without him. That led me to Jaco Pastorius, who led me to Wayne Shorter, who led me to Miles Davis. I had a simple rule. If Prince listened to it, I listened to it. In the wake of his death, everyone is talking about his genius. That's understandable. But most of the discussion is general. I like to think about specifics. I like to think of the way he innovated even early on, the way he turned away from the traditional blueprint of funk and soul music. Think about James Brown. Prince certainly did, as he did every funk and soul artist of his generation. But Prince was brilliantly perverse in the way he absorbed him. If Brown was about a tight crack snare and percussive horns as an extended rhythmic arm, Prince went in the opposite direction. He made undeniable funk from a dud of a dead snare sound and the artificial horns of the Oberheim synthesizer. Brown's magic streak ran between 1965 and 1975. Anyone who was anybody in black music borrowed from that period. But Prince looked to the period after that, when Brown was thought to be in decline. In sound checks, Prince would make the revolution endlessly play Brown's 1976 hit, Body Heat. It was like he was using the band as a sampler, and he looped that groove so that he could play along with it and eventually play around with it. It's Gonna Be a Beautiful Night is a brilliant reworking of Brown's Gravity from 1986. Who else was really listening to Brown at that point, let alone listening sharply enough to put his music through the replicator and remake it on the spot? Only Prince, who was perhaps Brown's truest heir. It was the 1999 track Something in the Water Does Not Compute that told me Prince was not a regular person or a regular musician. He'd removed the bass from the original demo, an innovation that would pay off even more powerfully on When Doves Cry, added a dizzying snare-hi-hat combination, and delivered his vocals in a kind of ice-cold, almost robotic manner. It wasn't just one new idea, it was several, all together. You knew from that song and the album tracks around it, Automatic, Lady Cab Driver, that he was going to be the new breed leader, stand up, organize. I got to meet Prince several times. I roller skated with him, but I always felt like a fan, never a peer. He was singular in his music. He was his own genre, and that same singularity extended to everything in his life. As he got older, the way he managed his career showed off that contrary streak. In the winter of 2012, the Revolution reunited at First Avenue in Minneapolis. They were all set up for him to join in and play. He drove right past. Prince was a great drummer, and he was always marching to his own beat. Control was job one to him, which allowed for amazing things in the studio and on stage, unprecedented leaps of inspiration and synthesis, and energy so prolific it seemed like it would never be shut off. But there was a level of mistrust when it came to letting the outside world in. There's so much we all don't know about him. This is what I do know. Much of my motivation for waking up at 5 a.m. to work, and sometimes going to bed at 5 a.m. after work, came from him. Whenever it seemed like too steep a climb, I reminded myself that Prince did it, so I had to also. For the past 20 years, whenever I was up at those hours, I knew that Prince was up too, somewhere, in a sense, sharing a workspace with me. Since he died, 5 a.m. has felt different. It's just a lonely hour now, a cold time before the sun comes up. The next tribute is from Lenny Kravitz. Prince opened up my imagination and showed me where I wanted to go as an artist. He was an African-American cat, skin color like mine, playing the guitar like I wanted to play. And not just guitar. He played nearly all the instruments on his albums, and it sounded like a band. The music, the vibe, the colors, the hair, the band. Everything was amazing to me as a teenager. Through his music, he was saying, "You can do this. This is how I did it. Now you do it your way." Later on, I got to know him as a friend. We got together all over the world. Paris, New York, Amsterdam, Minneapolis, Miami, wherever he happened to be. I would visit him at Paisley Park, which was an incredible place. It was like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, this larger-than-life compound that was just his world. We'd go and just jam, and he would film and record it. When we were done, he would hand me a cassette. He'd say, "This is just for you. I have the master tape here, and I'm going to lock it up. Everything isn't for business. It's about the art, the moment, the memory." He used to kick my behind at pool. His technique was amazing. He had the same attitude as he had on stage. He would just come at you. Once, when I was dating model Vanessa Paradise, I took her to his apartment in Paris. I think we were there from 11 p.m. to like 6 in the morning. Prince asked if she wanted to play pool, thinking he was going to destroy her, and she beat him terribly. It's a great memory. He could be incredibly funny. I remember watching a Chris Rock special at his house, and we just laughed and laughed. Another time, I hung out with him and Dave Chappelle. He loved having talented people like that around, whether they were musicians or artists or dancers or comedians. He was a loving guy. If he liked you, he really liked you and treated you beautifully. He could be aloof. There would be times I wouldn't hear from him for a year. Then he'd show up when you least expected it. I heard about his plane making an emergency landing, and I thought, okay, he dodged a bullet. And then, a week later, I got the news. I still haven't recovered. I really feel like a piece of me died. That's all we have time for today from the Rolling Stone Special Collector's Edition on Prince, The Ultimate Guide to His Music and Legend. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.